Chapter 36. Goldfish Point, La Jolla, California. "Mysteries have been solved and enigmas fathomed," Selma announced, walking into the workroom with Pete and Wendy trailing. Still on Madagascar time, Sam and Remy sat at the work table, each nursing a double espresso. As before, they'd slept through most of the transatlantic flight home, but still they were exhausted. After jumping from the bridge onto the paddle-wheel steamer, they decided to simply act the part of tourists, and after cleaning themselves up as best they could, strolled the decks and took in the scenery with their fellow passengers. Not only did no one ask to see their tickets, but they were served cocktails and a supper by white-coated stewards in the main salon. After having spent the day crawling through caves, wrangling crocodiles, fighting rebels, dodging falling boulders, and being chased through the Madagascar countryside, Sam and Remy relished the chance to simply sit and be pampered. 2 hours after they jumped aboard, the steamer docked at a pier jutting from a forested peninsula. Sam and Remy disembarked with everyone else and walked through a stone archway onto a well-groomed gravel path. At the end of this, they found a four-story mansion whose architectural style landed somewhere between antebellum plantation house and French country. A post-mounted plaque read, "Hotel Hermitage." Dumbfounded at finding such a place in the middle of the Madagascan wilds, Sam and Remy lingered as the rest of the ferry's passengers proceeded through the pergola-covered lobby entrance. Behind them, a female voice said in flawless French, "Welcome to the Hotel Hermitage." Sam and Remy turned to see a smiling black woman in a blue skirt and a crisp white blouse standing before them. Remy said, "Parlez-vous anglais?"
"Of course, madame. Can I be of assistance?"
Sam said, "It seems we've gotten separated from our tour group. Might you be able to arrange transportation for us back to Siafahi?" The woman smiled.
"Bien sûr."
An hour later, they arrived in Siafahi. One call to Selma took them to a private hostel for the evening, and the next morning they were on a charter flight to Maputo, Mozambique. Now Selma took a stool beside them.
"You two look tired,"
Sam said. "Perhaps we didn't properly regale you with the details of our Madagascan adventure." Selma nodded and waved her hand.
"Crocodiles, rebels, boulders.
Yes, I remember.
Meanwhile, we've been hard at work unraveling the unravelable."
"That's not a word. Did we mention the bridge we—" Remy intervened. "Selma, you have our full, if not fully animated, attention."
"Good. First things first. We sent your samples from the outrigger to the lab in Point Loma. We should have results in a couple of days. Remy, as you requested, I emailed your pictures of the outrigger and the scan of the Orizaga Codex to Professor Didel. He said he'll have some preliminary thoughts sometime tomorrow."
Remy saw Sam's questioning expression and said, "Stan Didel, my anthropology teacher at Boston College. Selma, did you—"
"I didn't give him any details. I simply said you wanted him to do a cursory examination." "Moving on to the mysterious Mr. Blaylock," Selma continued. "Pete and Wendy and myself—"
"Mostly us," Wendy said.
"Have read through most of Blaylock's letters to Ophelia's sister, Constance. Miss Cynthia was wrong. We think there was love between Blaylock and Constance. More on her part than his, though."
"Why do you say that?"
"The first couple of letters Blaylock mailed from Africa were mostly travelog. Blaylock is affectionate in a restrained way. He mentions that he wishes he could reciprocate Constance's feelings, but that he was—"
Selma consulted the legal pad before her.
"Afraid my grief over my dear Ophelia would turn to heart-rending guilt. He talks a lot about his early days in Bagamoyo, and even mentions my mission several times, but doesn't go into detail."
"Or so we thought," Pete added.
"Right. After the initial ones, we noticed that each of Blaylock's letters contained random dots beneath characters within the text."
Sam was nodding. "A code.
pull out the marked characters and combine them in a hidden message.
Yes, but Blaylock, ever the mathematician, didn't make it that simple. I'll spare you the details, but he used the dates and page numbers to create a subtraction filter. For example, if the filter is a 3, you take the letter G, subtract 3 characters, and get the letter D.
One of the first things we learned, Wendy said, is that Constance Ashworth was working for the Secret Service. She was his conduit to the powers that be. Sam chuckled.
I did not see that coming. How did you find out?
The hidden message in Blaylock's third letter read, Inform Camden ship in Bombay for repairs. Crew, Maximilian men all, quartered Stonetown.
What are Maximilian men? Asked Remy.
Sam answered. After the Civil War ended, Emperor Maximilian I of Mexico opened his doors to Confederate soldiers who wanted to fight on. At the time, the U.S. was backing partisans who were trying to overthrow Maximilian. He offered the Confederates quid pro quo. Fight for me first, then we'll take on the U.S. government. Estimates vary on how many Confederates went down there, but it was enough that Washington was concerned. When you combine Dudley's report that white men were crewing the El Mejide with Blaylock's mention of Maximilian, it adds up to a rogue Confederate intelligence operation. Someone went down to Mexico, recruited some sailors, and dispatched them to Zanzibar, where the El Mejide was waiting.
To what end?
To continue where the Shenandoah left off, I imagine. That ship did immense damage while she was active, and there were plenty of powerful factions in the Confederacy that swore to fight on, regardless of the surrender.
Wendy said, What confuses me is, how did they get access to the El Mejide?
Hard to say. One thing we do know is, the second Sultan of Zanzibar, the brother of the man who initially bought the Shenandoah, had no love for either his brother or that ship. And yet, when he had a chance to scuttle her after the 1872 hurricane, he didn't do it. In fact, he had her towed to Bombay and repaired at what was probably great expense.
Maybe this secret Confederate cabal had already purchased her, and the Sultan had no choice, said Pete.
Sam's brows furrowed at this. He stood up and walked to one of the computer workstations, where he began typing. After a couple minutes, he turned in his seat. Before he died, the first Sultan of Zanzibar had started to secretly crack down on the slave trade in his country. When his brother took over, the policy was reversed.
Selma was nodding.
So if, against all odds, the Confederacy rose again, the second Sultan would have a built-in market for his slave industry.
It's all speculation, of course, but the pieces seem to fit.
Okay. Go back to Blaylock's first coded message, Remy said. He mentions Camden. Who's Camden?
Camden, New Jersey, is where Thomas Haynes Dudley was born, Summer replied. We think it was Blaylock's nickname for him rather than an official code name. In fact, Dudley had his own moniker for Blaylock. Jotun.
It's from Norse mythology, Wendy added. Jotun was a giant with superhuman strength.
Of course, Sam said. Jotun. I don't know how I missed that.
Remy lightly punched his arm. Smart Alec. Don't mind him, Wendy. Go ahead, Selma.
In another letter to Dudley via Constance, dated July 1872, Blaylock reported that the El Mejide, now redubbed Shenandoah, we presume, had returned to port with her crew already aboard. Blaylock suspects the repairs on the ship had been completed at least a month prior, and that the ship and crew had been at sea since then.
Were there any unaccounted-for attacks or losses in the area during that time? Asked Sam.
Dozens. For a long time, the Indian Ocean was a bigger pirate haven than the Caribbean. But we weren't able to connect the Shenandoah 2 to any of the losses. It's at this point the story gets stranger. Blaylock ends his report with this line.
have acquired reliable vessel and received sharps.
As in sharps carbines? Sam asked. Selma nodded. Dudley must have arranged for them to be shipped to Blaylock.
Selma went on. Nilo-Hamitic crew learning rapidly and overcoming fear of water. Expect to be fit to give chase by month's end. Intend to catch them red-handed.
Nilo-Hamitic, Sam repeated. Never heard of them.
I have, Remy replied. Nilo-Hamitic is an outdated name for the Maasai tribe. It appears our mysterious Mr. Blaylock recruited a guerrilla army of Maasai warriors to chase down the Shenandoah too.
Well, I'll give him this much, Sam said. The man had a flair for the dramatic. According to Morton's biography of Blaylock, he lived with the Maasai for a while.
He did, Selma replied. As far as we can tell from his letters, he explored the area inland from Bagamoyo and became friendly with some Maasai. That's how he started the recruitment.
Okay, so it's July 1872. The Shenandoah too has a new crew and she's prepped for battle. What then?
Most of what happened next we got from Blaylock's coded reports, and some of it we matched against what few dated entries we found in his journal. A couple weeks later, Blaylock and his crew put to sea in a boom, essentially a large two-masted dhow, and began hunting the Shenandoah too, which slipped out of port a few days ahead of them. This cat-and-mouse game goes on for a month. Blaylock hears a report that a ship matching the Shenandoah 2's description has sunk two U.S.-flagged cargo ships near the Gulf of Aden. According to our databases, two ships were sunk in that area around the dates Blaylock mentions. The losses were attributed to pirates.
Not far off the mark, Sam observed.
Though Blaylock isn't a seaman, he proves an able captain, and the Maasai an adept crew. Blaylock knows he doesn't dare attack the Shenandoah too, either directly or at sea, so all through July and August he does his best to shadow her. He gathers intelligence reports and bides his time until the night of September 16th. He catches the Shenandoah too at anchor off St. Anne Island in the Seychelles, about 1,300 miles east of Zanzibar. Blaylock anchors his boom in a nearby cove, then he and his men go ashore, sneak across the headland, and, in true pirate fashion, swim out to the Shenandoah and take her by storm. Not a single shot is fired, but the Maasai, being the warriors they are, show little mercy. Of Shenandoah 2's crew of 78, only 6 survive. The captain, another officer, and 4 enlisted men. Blaylock's official report of the capture reaches the U.S. in November. He tells Dudley that he put the Shenandoah 2's survivors ashore on St. Anne Island.
Do we know what became of them? Remy asked.
Unfortunately, I found nothing. Blaylock then splits his crew between the boom and the Shenandoah 2 and sets off for the return voyage to Zanzibar. 300 miles east of the Seychelles, they encounter a storm, and the Shenandoah 2 sinks.
At this, Sam and Remy leaned forward together.
Sinks? Remy repeated. How in the world?
Along with his report to Dudley, Blaylock includes a coded message for Constance.
Selma flipped a page on her legal pad and traced her finger down a couple lines.
Having secured the Shenandoah, we promptly took inventory of her stores and goods. To my great surprise, in the captain's cabin I found a most remarkable item, a statuette of a great green-jeweled bird consisting of a mineral unfamiliar to me and depicting a species I have never encountered. I must admit, dear Constance, I was entranced.
Sam and Remy were silent as they absorbed this. Finally, Sam said, "That explains the line in his journal. The great green-jeweled bird."
"And all the bird sketches," Remy added.
"And maybe what we found in Morton's museum in Bagamoyo."
Remember all the stuffed birds hanging from the ceiling, Sam? He was obsessed. What else did he say in the letter, Selma?
I'm paraphrasing, but here's the gist of it. He's done his duty for his country, not once, but twice, and he lost his wife in the process. He admits he lied to Dudley about the Shenandoah II's sinking. He begs Constance's forgiveness and tells her he intends to discover where the Shenandoah II's crew found the jeweled bird and recover the rest of the treasure.
What treasure? Sam asked.
At that point, does he have any hint there's more to find? If he did, he never jotted a word about it, at least not in plain text. Given the nature of his journal, it may all be hidden in there somewhere.
What about the Shenandoah II's captain's log? Remy asked. If Blaylock was assuming the previous crew had found the jeweled bird during their travels, the log would be a natural place to start.
He never mentions a log, but I agree with your assumption.
Sam said, my guess? He transcribed whatever he found relevant in the captain's log to his own journal.
At any rate, Selma continued, Blaylock continued to write Constance after the Shenandoah II's capture, but his letters became more and more irrational. You can read them yourself, but it's clear Blaylock was descending into insanity.
And those are just the plain text portions of the letters, Pete added. We've still got 14 to decode.
If we're to believe all this, Sam said, then Winston Blaylock probably spent the remainder of his life sailing the ocean aboard the Shenandoah II, scribbling in his journal, staring at his jeweled bird, and carving glyphs on the inside of the bell while looking for a treasure that may or may not have existed.
It may be even bigger than that, Remy said. If the Orizaga Codex is genuine and the outrigger is what we think it is, somewhere along the way Blaylock may have stumbled onto a secret that was buried with Cortez and his conquistadors. The true origin of the Aztecs.